Okay, we've come in our study of Romans 10 to the end of that first paragraph where Paul has been talking about how the Jews had a zeal for God, but it was misguided and falsely founded, and it was rooted in the fact that they participated in that problem of ever learning and never coming to a knowledge. So they didn't know about God's righteousness, and they did substitute another goal, and that was to establish their own. And as a consequence, they ended up in a rebellious status against God because they would not submit themselves to the principles of His righteousness and the methodology for achieving it. According to verse 2, they pursued a righteousness that was in accordance with law, but it was not in accordance with knowledge, and they ignored they were actually actively and violently opposed to the gospel that contained a righteousness from God by faith. That's how Romans was introduced back in chapter 1, that there is a righteousness in the gospel from God to man on the basis of faith, according to Habakkuk 2:4. And though the Jews knew Habakkuk 2:4, they did not connect the reality of justification by grace through faith, even though that went all the way back, according to Romans 4, to Abraham. So there was a lot of complication, and in the first century, the antagonism of the Jews toward any kind of concept of righteousness from God that was rooted in anything except their own performance was just anathema to them. They didn't want to hear it. They wouldn't accept the notion that if you were to compare the gravity of their sin to the paucity of their righteous behavior, they wouldn't stand a chance of being accepted by God on the basis of their performance. They thought they were doing quite well, thank you. And as a consequence of that, they exalted themselves in their own performance and they devalued the significance and impact of what sin's all about. Their idea of sin was a very minor thing, apparently, because that's the only way you could even have a dream that you would be able to approach God on the basis of your works and come out unscathed. It's an amazing thing, 2,000 years on this side of the whole theological issue, because we see with a lot more opportunity for clarity, even though we don't necessarily have it even today. So, at the end of the paragraph, Paul just makes this comment. They didn't subject themselves to the righteousness of God, for Christ is the end of law for righteousness to everyone who believes. Now, the next paragraph, starting in verse 5, is going to go into the difference between the righteousness that's based in law and the righteousness that's based on faith, and he's going to say quite a bit about that. But this evening I want us to zero in on this issue of Christ being the end of law for everyone who believes, because in his explanation of the failure of his kinsmen according to the flesh to obtain a righteous standing before God as an issue of the basis for acceptance by God, so that God would examine their righteousness and then grant them acceptance by himself for them or of them. In Paul's explanation of that failure, he made two major points. He made the point that the kinsmen wanted to be accepted by God, but they wanted on the basis of their own diligent pursuit of the dictates of the law, because it would leave them with their sense of superiority and pride intact. The Jews had an extremely highly developed sense of superiority over both Samaritans and Gentiles, and they didn't even make an effort to hide it. They called the Gentiles dogs, and they called the Samaritans worse. And they never even considered that their attitude of that superiority was sinful. It was their right to feel this way because they were the people of God and they performed the commandments of God and they had the law of God and they were the obedient son. So, but that whole idea of gaining acceptance and maintaining and keeping your sense of superiority over others actually made them antagonists of God, because they refused to submit themselves to the issues of the righteousness of God, which Paul has already explained in the first 11 chapters of this, well, the first 9 chapters of this book before we got into this paragraph. He's already explained that the righteousness of God assumes two basic, very basic confidences that you embrace. One of them is the sinfulness of yourself. That's why he starts out in the book of Romans dealing with the sinfulness issue and how he says there is none righteous, not even one. There is none that does good. They're altogether become unprofitable, Jew and Gentile alike. So he hammers that because it's so necessary. Men don't seek salvation and acceptance from God on the basis of the gospel unless they see themselves as hopeless without it. As long as they retain this notion that they can earn this acceptance by behaving, they can salvage their pride in the process, as long as they hang on to that, they can't be saved. So the gospel is good news simply because it's preceded by this horrible news. The sin of man is so profoundly horrible that it caused the death of the Son of God. And being that horrible, you just don't do anybody any favors by diminishing the badness of it. If you make sin out to be something inconsequential, you just destroyed whoever believes you. So he made that point, but he also made the point that those who were on this wrong path, his kinsmen according to the flesh, were on it because they rejected this truth of verse 4, that Christ was the end of law for righteousness for those who believe. So that's the point we're going to look at this evening. If the Jews had known about the righteousness of God in verse 3, instead of being ignorant of it, they would clearly understand what verse 4 was driving at. But they didn't, and they despised the one that the Christians called Christ because of his doctrine. I've said this before, but John the Baptizer's name was God is gracious, or Yahweh is gracious, and he was the introduction to the period of grace, where the whole issue of God's character shifted a little bit away from the concept of an unapproachable, justice-based judge. There are a whole lot of words you could stick in there, but judge is as good as any of them. It was a relatively significant shift from the God as judge thesis to the gracious God. Theologically, it was an enormous shift in terms of where Israel had come to by the first century, because by the time they came to the first century, they were so enraged with God that when he appeared in their midst, they despised him with everything that was in them and sought to kill him, and eventually got Rome to do that. They didn't have any idea how much of the character and attitude of their father, the devil, they had embraced. They just didn't have a clue. And because of that, the idea that Christians could go around saying that Christ is the end of law for everyone who believes, just ground on them, because the law was their way of life. And they were expecting eternal life as the outcome of their way of life because they had fixated on this law issue. So the thing that we want to understand that in verse 4, when he says Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes, the issue there is the righteousness issue. He's the end of law for righteousness. So that the key idea is, where are you going to get a sufficient righteousness that will allow God to accept you without criticism? How are you going to go before God and have him be able to look at all that you have done, thought, said, intended, and all the rest, and come out unscathed on the other end of that evaluation, given that God knows everything about you anyway? I mean, on what basis do you have any hope at all in that, in view of righteousness, real righteousness, not just this facade stuff where you do what you do for the approval of people who see the outward appearance? And that's all the Jews were worried about. In fact, I had an illustration presented to me this past week when a person asked me what I thought about cremation, because there's this fixation among some who call themselves Christian that you can't be cremated as a Christian because you'll be destroying your body and that'll keep God from being able to raise you from the dead, which I have never heard anything so mindless in all my life. I mean, it's like, that would eliminate anybody that was burned up as a martyr. The most faithful Christians in the world would not be able to be raised because their bodies were burned up. Well, that's just plumb dumb. And then, what do you do with this person who falls overboard and four different sharks eat four different parts of his body and swim off into four different directions of the ocean and die somewhere out there and his body's scattered all over everywhere, you know? But the root of that whole idea is that this external stuff is the critical stuff. It's like God doesn't have a data bank of the DNA of everybody that's ever come to life, and that he can't create or recreate a body, a spiritual body, that would be completely in harmony with the basic makeup of the physical body, only putting it in a glorified state. Because Paul said there is a difference in the glory. The seed has a certain glory and the plant has another glory. So the physical body under sin has a certain glory, but the glorified body has a whole different thing. But it is nonetheless a body. All I'm saying that for is to make this point. People look on the outward appearance. They think that the external stuff is the critical stuff. So you don't dare have a Christmas tree in your house at Christmas because the Christmas tree came from some pagan origin. And I want to say, well, so did shoes. And everybody wears shoes. And it's just like, if you do these things, that automatically means your heart is involved in the things that the hearts of the people who originated it were doing. So that if the original Christmas tree establisher had a heart to worship a false god, then by using a Christmas tree, you're sharing in his heart attitude. And that's impossible. You don't even know who it was or what his heart attitude was. But this is Jewish. This is the Jewish era, where you only worry about appearances. And if you can get the appearances right, then God will be impressed. And that's a fundamental flaw in the whole concept of righteousness. Because even the Jewish scriptures said, man's the one that looks on the outward appearance. God looks on the heart. So whenever he sees you do anything, he looks to see what your motive was. And that's a heart issue. And if the motive was good, then the behavior is acceptable. But if the heart's bad, you ain't nothing you can do to make that behavior good. You can call it good behavior if it creates a benefit for somebody, but the doing of it's not good. That's like, how can you, being evil, give good gifts to your children when you give them food to eat? Well, the food's a good gift, but the giving of it by a depraved parent is not a good thing, because the parent's doing it for other reasons than godly. So the issue here is the reason they didn't accept Christ as the end of the law for righteousness is because they didn't even have a clue what righteousness was. So that's the point. Earlier in this context, Paul made the point that righteousness was obtained by the Gentiles who did nothing to pursue it. The Gentiles who didn't pursue it got it. And those who pursued a kind of righteousness rooted in law didn't get it. That's what he said back there in verse 30. What shall we say? The Gentiles didn't pursue and they got it. And the Israel pursuing didn't get it. The Jews just didn't want to hear that. You can't give those Gentiles something that we deserve. They didn't even try. And all we do is try. Do and do and do. So that's the earlier context of this statement, that in view of righteousness, Christ is the end of law. And critical to that issue of obtaining what you didn't pursue for, or not obtaining what you were pursuing, the most basic end of that pursuit is a goal. And the goal is a goal of obtaining something. But the obtaining that they were seeking was not righteousness in and of itself. They wanted righteousness for what it could get them. And even the offer of the righteousness of Christ is not an offer primarily for us to be righteous. It's because of what righteousness does for us in respect to our relationship with God. So, when everything's said and done, the issue before men is whether or not they'll be allowed to have the righteousness that will qualify them for the participation in the kingdom of the Lord and of his Christ, so that they will experience the exulting joy of such permission. In other words, seeking after righteousness wasn't seeking after righteousness as the end goal. It was seeking after the privilege of being able to participate in the life, in the joy of life forever. That's the only reason you need righteousness. Is so that you can be accepted by the God who pours his joy over those who are justified in his eyes. God's goal for us isn't righteousness, it's life. But righteousness is an integral issue in getting to that point of having life, because you can't have life if you're antagonized by God or antagonistic to God, or God's antagonized by you. There's not going to be any joy shared between the antagonists. Everything's got to come to peace, and peace is impossible where there's unrighteousness. So, at the heart of this permission, the Jews didn't get what they were pursuing. They weren't given permission to enter into the kingdom of life and peace and joy on the basis of their performance. And the Gentiles, who weren't even worrying about it, were given it as a gift because they believed the gospel when Paul preached it to them. And so the whole issue is, it's not about righteousness per se. That is the key in this verse. He's the end of righteousness. But the issue there is, what does righteousness bring you? And the answer to that is an eternity of exulting joy or an eternity of indescribable grief. If you get righteousness, you'll have the eternity of joy. And if you don't get it, Katie, bar the door. You don't even want to know what it's going to be like. And there isn't any way out of it after you get there. So that's the real issue, the exulting joy. And at the heart of that exulting joy issue is a question. Can exulting joy exist without the powerful sense of personal accomplishment that rests at the root of all men's considerations and methods for life? Now let me explain what I mean by that question. The Jews wanted the exulting joy of life, but they were absolutely convinced that they couldn't have the exulting joy without the sense of superiority that their performance had brought them over all those who didn't perform well enough. In other words, built into the idea of the joy of life as a methodology was the pride of life. If I can't look at something that I've done that has qualified me for this participation in joy, then I can't be joyful. That was the Jewish mindset. The way to joy is a sense of self-superiority. And you know, when I see that the Jews were so fixated on preserving their sense of superiority, because that's what made them happy. They had this sense of exulting joy whenever they could look down their nose at all these people that weren't doing as good a job as them. When they could condemn somebody for evil and even put him to death for his evil, they did it out of a sense of, well, I'm not like that. And I'm glad I'm not like that, because I've done all these other things that are good. And that scumbag needs, you know, that's the way they thought. So for them, the joy of life was tied to what John calls the pride of life, this arrogance of performance. And when we look at our culture, one of the first things that sticks out really clearly is that in all the considerations of man's fallen thought, self-esteem is rooted in both the idea that joy springs from a well-adjusted sense of self and in the idea that such a well-adjusted sense of self is the critical spring of life. In other words, you don't want to do anything to this poor child or you'll cripple his self-esteem and that'll ruin him for life and he'll never have a life of joy. Or if you get in a situation where you're humiliated, there's no possibility of joy for you in that humiliation. So you want to do everything you can not to be humiliated. Tied to that is this notion that life consists in being able to have a good sense of self. I'm a good person. I've done good things. I deserve what I'm getting in terms of good, joy, and all that. And if you take that away, the Jews said, you're taking our joy away. There is no way that we can be joyful if we have to admit that we're just as bad as they are. So in the world of fallen men, this issue of, you know, don't humiliate anybody, don't say anything bad about them, you'll destroy their self-esteem. The whole issue there is, in my mind, joy comes from the pride of life. If I can't feel good about myself, I can never be joyful. And even among those who have been delivered by God from His condemnation, even believers' voices are being added to that. I've heard and read of the sneering comment about, well, that's just worm theology. And what they mean by that is, oh, you're telling us that we have to believe that we're bad, that we're just worms, that we have no capacity in ourselves for doing anything but sinfulness. And I reject that out of hand. And a lot of so-called believers are in that rejection of worm theology. But the scriptures are the ones that said, but I am a worm and no man. And the whole idea that my joy is tied to who I am or what I've achieved, that's at the root of it. So alternatively, the gospel and the word of God declares that it's not self-esteem that issues forth in exulting joy. What issues forth in exulting joy is being esteemed highly by God. Hasn't anything to do with how I feel about myself. Has everything to do about how He feels about me. I can honestly feel totally unworthy of the sacrifice of Christ for me and be exulting in joy because Christ was a sacrifice for me. If God loves me, it doesn't matter if I love myself or not. And so you see this huge mix-up, and if for 1,500 years the Jews had bought into this nonsense that you have to be superior to somebody in order to feel good about yourself, in order to have joy. And Paul's gospel says the beginning of joy is a confession of your sinfulness. So, it is the glory of God that pours the joy of life out on anybody that actually possesses it. It's not the glory of man that does this. God's record of the glory of man is that he's been corrupted by sin. And if I have to deal with him according to his behavior, I'm going to have to send off into eternal Gehenna. And there'll be no joy there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to absorb the cost of that in myself through the death of my own son. And then I can give them the joy of life as they participate in my love for them. And it won't be tied to their love for me. It'll be tied to my love for them, because this whole issue is the exulting joy comes from the impact that the glory of God has in the production of a kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy forever. So there is this contrast in the scriptures between man's methodology, which says, in order to be joyful, I have to be superior, and God's theology, which says, man doesn't have to have any basis in himself to think of himself as capable or superior in order to have the joy of life. All he's got to do is be in the presence of God. If he's accepted by God, he'll have the joy. And it doesn't have anything to do with his own character or qualifications or any of that. So, it's because of the reality that God accepts no man who doesn't possess the critical qualification for acceptance, which is righteousness, that Paul says Christ is the end of the law for righteousness. In view of the issue of righteousness, which is, though it's not said in the text, is the issue of being accepted by God so you can experience His joy. In view of that issue, Christ is the end of the law. Now, that brings us to the issue of being the end of something. It says that Christ is the end in view of those for whom He is the end. And there are two issues there, and we're going to look at the one that the translators in Paul himself actually refers to secondly, and that is, He's the end of law for righteousness to the believer. To the believer, to the one who believes. The issue of the believer. This is the word in the scriptures that is used in respect to the relational universe that God created as soon as He created persons. There was a physical creation so that they would have a sphere of existence where they could have a physical identity and capabilities and all that. But within that context of that physical creation, there was a relational creation, because the first thing that wasn't good about the physical creation was that it left Adam without anybody to help him. He was alone. So he went through the entire animal kingdom, couldn't find anybody that was suitable to be a helper to him. So God put him to sleep and created a helper. And now he's not alone anymore. So in a relational universe, that's the issue, as being in a harmony, in a relationship with somebody else. And in the scriptures, the somebody else's multiply. You're supposed to be in a relationship with the God who made you, first and foremost, and that's the primary relationship. But then everybody that you can get along with because they believe the same thing about this relationship with God thing enhances the quality of your experience of this relational reality, because you get along believing the same things. So this word believe is the key. It's the most fundamental requirement of relationship. That's why the scriptures focus on faith from Genesis to Revelation. It is by faith, by faith. Why? Because you can't have harmony in relationship without trust. That's what faith's all about. So Paul uses the term that has to do with this key issue of a relational universe where the joy is rooted. The joy is rooted in a relationship between the individual and the God in whose presence is the fullness of joy. But John wrote 1 John and said, we're writing these things to you so that you can share in the joy too. So there's a sharing horizontally with those who are sharing the joy vertically. If I'm in fellowship with God and have His joy, then if you're in fellowship with God and having His joy, then we can have more joy between the two of us because we're in harmony with each other as well as with God. That's the logic of that whole thing. So he uses this word, believe, but he uses it in the present tense because believing is a necessary ingredient. Now, Luke reveals for us, because he was Paul's understudy, Luke heard probably everything Paul had to say about the truth because he accompanied him on so much of his journeys and was with him through all kinds of different situations. But Luke's the one who tells us that there is such a thing as believing for a while and then abandoning it. And Paul was the originator of that understanding for Luke. And we see in the writings of Paul, in one particular that I'll mention in just a minute, that Paul recognizes that there is such a thing as believing for a while, but the believing dies on the vine because of the stresses that are created by the lack of harmony between men and men and men and God. So that if a person believes and then is subjected to persecution or difficulty caused by the stresses in relationship and his faith dies on the vine, then you have Luke saying the seed sown on stony ground is those who believe for a while, but when persecution arises, they abandon it. Paul recognized that because he was the origin of it in Luke's theology. And we see that most clearly in one of the most succinct statements of the gospel by Paul given anywhere in his writings. And that's in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 1 through 11. And in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 1 through 11, we have this real clear presentation. Paul says, now I make known to you the gospel which we preach to you. And the gospel which we preach to you is, number one, Christ died for our sins, according to the scriptures. That he was buried, and that he was raised from the dead, according to the scriptures, and that he was seen. He was seen by the apostles, and he was seen by over 500 other people. So this is the gospel that we preach to you. That's 1 Corinthians 15, verses 1, and skip 2, and go down to 3, 4, 5. Down through 11. Well, why do we skip 2? Well, because there are so many people who are skipping verse 2. But 1 Corinthians 15:2 says, if you keep in memory and have not believed in vain. And what Paul is saying is, it's possible when you hear the gospel for you to have a favorable believing response. But if that favorable believing response isn't maintained, the relationship dies on the vine. And how I've settled that in my own thinking is that there is a progression in believing from the initial part where you believe something that God says, but God doesn't justify you just because of that. So you grow in your confidence in things that God says until you get to a certain point where your faith is gelled, and that's the point where God justifies you. And I make my argument on the basis of Genesis 12 and 15. In Genesis 12, Abraham obviously believed the promises that God made in Genesis 12, 1 to 3, because he left his homeland and went off to this land that God was going to show him. Now, his faith may not have been very potent at that point, because he didn't leave his father's house. He took his father with him, and he also had a nephew that went with him. But he went, which is an evidence of faith. By faith, he left a land to go to a land. But when he got to the land, it was in famine. So here he is. He's in the land that God has shown him, this is going to be your land. And Abraham says, well, I'm going to supply for my flocks and herds and all that. So I got to leave this land that God has provided for me. I got to go down to Egypt. Well, he goes down to Egypt. And he lies about Sarah. And he gets in trouble with the Pharaoh over that. And Pharaoh has given him all kinds of herds and flocks and stuff. And he boots him out. Says, I ain't going to have a liar like you threatening my entire kingdom because you lied to me about this woman. And God told me if I touch her, I'm dead. You're out of here, man. Get. Well, he didn't take back all the flocks and herds. He let Abraham be richer in flocks and herds to send him back to a famine-stricken land. So now it's even worse. And it's made even worse than that, because in the meantime, the Pharaoh gave Sarah Hagar, and Hagar becomes a little nasty hook in the whole process, and Satan uses it, because Hagar is where Ishmael comes from. So that whole storyline is about the beginning of faith, and how it flags on occasion because of difficulties, but when the first thing Abraham does when he gets back to the land is build an altar, which means that his faith is being recovered from all this stumbling around. And then in Genesis 15, Abraham just plain comes right out and says it. You promised me a son. You haven't given me a son. This guy's going to be my heir. And God says, oh, wait a minute. Come on outside. I want to show you something. And he tells him, enumerate the stars. Tell me the significance of this. That's what your son is going to be. And Abraham believed God, and then God justified him, declared him righteous. That's Genesis 15. That's when his faith gelled. And I believe that Paul understood this whole issue, that the first time you hear the gospel, you may have a favorable response, you may even believe what you've been told, but that isn't the kind of faith that God responds to with justification. That thing has to gel. That's one reason Paul had real problems with the Galatians. He said, I don't even know what to think about you people, because you said you believed. I thought you believed by what I was seeing. But this apostasy thing has me scared to death for you, because I don't know if you really believed it or not. So the whole issue of a prior belief that falls apart under the stresses of conflict is, I think, established by 1 Corinthians 15:2, and it is there because of the reality that relationships cannot exist in the face of a non-existent belief or trust. If a person has believed something that God has said and started on the path, and then his faith just completely disappears, there's no relational possibilities there because the trust is gone. I think it even can be argued that the vast majority of Paul's writings in the New Testament were actually inspired by this fact that relationships require trust. If you're going to have a relationship with God, you've got to be believing. That's why I use the present tense. You've got to be believing. And that's why to the Thessalonians he said, God is calling us. And why I said when I was teaching that the call consists of this. Are you going to trust me here or not? Because the relationship that we have together is rooted in whether or not you're going to trust what I'm telling you. And if you don't trust me, then our relationship is strained and you don't have the joy of life, because you cannot get that from a strained relationship. So, the whole issue here is that if Christ is not the end of law for righteousness, there's no escape from the disastrous bondage of law and all of the critical demand performance issues that are involved. If there's not an end to law, then we're sunk. Relationships can't survive in a constant critical situation where everything you do, there's something wrong with it and the flaws are being pointed out. You can't have a relationship with somebody who's a hypercritic. And that's what God is when he's the judge. He's hypercritical because he sees the motives, he sees the actions, he sees how flawed are the motives and how flawed are the actions, and under judgment there isn't any way, there's no hope. So, this issue of believing is critical. The issue is a constant ongoing trusting where you are willing to accept what God is declaring as true and believing it and going forward in your relationship with him by trusting him day after day after day. There is, in Reformed theology, they call it the perseverance of the saints. And they call it that because they recognize that the scriptures teach that you need to be believing. And if you don't believe, then there's a problem. And so they've decided that doctrinally, the Bible teaches that the saints will, the elect, will persevere. They call it the perseverance of the saints. But I really believe that if you were to push them, they'd admit that's really not the perseverance of the saints. It's the perseverance of the convicting God who comes along to those who are not trusting, that are His children, and He crowds them into trusting Him again. That's really what happened to Abraham when he went to Egypt. God started crowding him. Abraham's failure of faith caused him to lie to Pharaoh. So what did God do? He went to Pharaoh and said, "That guy lied to you." He brought Abraham up short for his lies. And then he brought him up short for not trusting that the provision of the land would be sufficient for him, because Pharaoh piled on all these other animals and just kicked him out. So he had to go back. So in a very real sense, it's not the perseverance of the saints, it's the perseverance of the saints' God, who continues to work on us and crowd us into returning to this confidence. So Christ being the end is a huge issue, because what that means is that we have a completely adequate foundation for believing that God means what He says in terms of promises. Because He fulfilled the promise of a Redeemer who would die for all of our sins and erase all of the condemnation of justice, if we can trust Him for that, then all these other promises, which are far lesser than that, can be trusted to. That's the whole push. Christ is the end of the law. But the issue of the end for believers introduces the issue that He is the end as we are believing Him. As we trust Him, then law is lost in the mix. We don't have to worry about it, because Christ is the end of that. But that brings us then to the issue of this end in terms of the word law, because it says the end of the law in English, but it's not. It's the end of law. It's not the end of the law. Typically in the scriptures, the law is always a reference to Mosaic writings, the law that came down from Sinai. But law, without that definite article, simply means the whole principle. And the whole principle of law is demand, perform, relationships established. You do what I tell you and we'll be in harmony with each other. And that's the way human beings operate. You do what I tell you. It's just like the old outlaw said to the former sheriff, "I'm an easy man to get along with as long as you agree with me. I won't shoot anybody that says, 'Yeah, you're right.'" Well, that's law. That's the whole issue of basing relationship on performance. And that's why Paul said it won't work. So, the law came through Moses, but law, without the definite article, is simply a reference to the whole methodology issue. And the methodology of law is perform what you've been commanded to perform. On the alternative thing, the methodology of faith, is that God makes a promise that does have implications about your behavior, but the implications about your behavior are automatically resolved as you are trusting the promise. If Abraham's trusting the promise of the land, he doesn't go to Egypt. Then he doesn't have to lie about Sarah's relationship with it. He doesn't have to get Hagar in his household. He doesn't get bawled out by the Pharaoh and embarrassed to death, because he believed the promise, and therefore his behavior was controlled by his faith in the commitment that God had made. That's the whole issue. When faith is the methodology, God makes promises and men depend on them as they go about their activities. The methodology of law is God makes demands and men just try their best to obey them, but they don't. So Christ as the end of law means that the principle of relationship rooted in performance of demand is gone. Obedience as a concept under man's thinking has to be put in a cage and kept there. I know lots and lots of preachers and teachers who think that you need to tell people that they need to obey. You need to obey. You need to obey. And they go to the Bible and say, "See, it says obey." Well, they never look at the word. Obey comes right off of the verb pytho, which means to be persuaded. Obedience is the automatic result of being persuaded of something that's true, and you believe it's true, and because you believe it's true, it automatically adjusts the way you decide what you're going to do. It's not about obedience. It's about being persuaded. And I'm not opposed to people obeying God as long as it's rooted in persuasion. I'm totally opposed to men who think they're obeying God simply because they're doing what God's Word says. In this case, you have to do that without faith. It's just a matter of this is the performance that's required, and I'm doing the performing, so everything's fine. That's a hopeless mess. So, the real issue in Christ being the end of law is the issue of being convinced by God. Genuine conviction that addresses then the choices that you make. And thus, we have in verse 4 this statement. Christ is the end of law as a methodology for the person who believes. Under the methodology of faith, you are never going to be criticized or condemned by God because of a failure of performance. Your performance will be evaluated. The judgment seat of Christ says so. But it will not be in view of condemnation, and I think probably it won't even be really a matter of being critical. God's going to see that your behavior in certain circumstances was hay and stubble, and he's going to demonstrate that that's what it was by testing it with fire, and it all burns up. But I don't hear God saying, man, if you had just been a little bit more obedient, everything would have been fine. I don't think that's what's going to happen there. I think in the final analysis, he's going to say, okay, this is the way you lived. Hits it with fire. This is what you got left. Based on this, I'm going to plug you in here in the kingdom. It's done. So, verse 4 is a crucial verse at the end of this paragraph. Christ has put an end to the critical judgment of God in terms of punitive behavior on God's part because we didn't perform well enough. Christ performed absolutely perfectly, and you can't improve on it. And that's where our confidence has to rest, in His performance. And resting there, we can have peace, and having peace, we can be joyful.